right after this.
Prison Pipeline will air a Valentine's Day special to bring to light the fact that, because of incarceration, many people are separated from their friends, family, and lovers on Valentine's Day. We will be reading your short messages to your friends and loved ones on air. So whether you are behind bars and reaching out, or are out and reaching in, we welcome you to mail or email us your Valentine's messages. Our email address is kbooppc@gmail.com, and our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Address your messages to Prison Pipeline Collective. Then tune in on February 15th at 6:30 p.m. to hear your messages read on air.
The KBOO Foundation is seeking to fill two vacancies on the Board of Directors. The Board will elect the new directors at the February Board meeting. Are you interested in nonprofit governance and in helping to shape the future of your community radio station? Do you have 10 to 15 hours per month to support KBOO? Then this may be just the right opportunity for you. The application and instructions are posted on the KBOO website, kboo.fm, and paper copies are available at the station. In order to be eligible to fill one of these two vacant seats on the KBOO Board of Directors, you must be a KBOO member and you must submit a complete application by either emailing the document at kboocommunity@gmail.com, or by mailing or dropping off the completed documents to the station to the attention of Timothy Welp, KBOO Community Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please send in your application by 5 p.m. February 15, 2016. If you have any questions, please contact the nominating committee at kboocommunity@gmail.com. Thank you for your support of Community Radio.
And now, as promised, Patricia Smith talking about her life and work and reading some poems on the incomparable Radio Zine on KBOO Portland, your community radio.
This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Patricia Smith is here, the winner of the Bobbitt Prize. And this book is a book that's going to stay forever. It's Should Have Been Jimmy Savannah. And I want to introduce you to Patricia, and I want to ask her, what is this book about?
Hi, Grace. So good to be here. This book started out to be about Motown. I love Motown music. I thought, I'm going to write a book that explains why Motown music held such sway over me. And it was Motown's 50th anniversary when I started the book. So I said, I'll write some poems about Motown artists, about some songs. And then in the midst of doing that, I realized it wasn't really about Motown. It was about being first generation up north. It was the fact that my parents, my father came from Arkansas, my mother from Alabama, settled in Chicago. And as you might imagine, they were kind of confounded. You know, they were country people, and all of a sudden they had to learn how to negotiate the city. And my mother's way of introducing me to the world was trying to keep me away from it. She wasn't quite sure what was going on out there, so I was left to my own devices quite a bit. And I became addicted to the radio. And back then, songs told stories. So Motown music, all my ideas about life, love, and romance were pretty much defined by whatever Motown song was out at the time. But when I realized that what I was writing about was just those early days in Chicago and how we kind of made our way, the book took on kind of a poetic memoir feel. You know, I went back and some things that I thought I had paved over that I thought I was never going to look at again just rose to the surface. And so it took it was roughly chronological, started with my imagining of how my parents met, because you know how you look at your parents and go, I don't see how these two people ever got together. But then, you know, talked about them having me and what it was like I lived in a part of town, I'm from Chicago originally, lived in a part of town where all of the people who came from the South were funneled there, and it later became one of the country's largest ghettos. But at the time, you don't know. You know, it's your home. So
this is cultural history. This is sociological history. And I'm telling you something, Patricia, I haven't seen words put together like this since Dylan Thomas.
That's so nice of you. Thank you so much.
And I read a lot of poetry.
Well, I think it was because it was really close to me. It was my attempt to piece together my history.
But the language. The language. She's going to read some to you now. And this is Patricia Smith. We're at the Library of Congress. She's going to open up with a poem for you. And just listen up.
All right. I'm going to open up with a poem called Shedding. And this is a little bit of what happened when my mother and father split up and my father moved out of the house. She screamed when she saw the clumps of hair in my hand. The slowly uncrumpling wads stuffing the sink drain, the nappy tufts clinging to the slick white walls of the tub. In disbelief, she dragged her claw across my scalp, then stared at the thick tendrils that easily came away with her hand. "Girl, what did you do?" she demanded, deciding that the loss of my hair was punishment for some closeted purple sin. So then began the questions. Did you let anybody touch you? You've been going to school every day. Have you been stopping off at that place where they sell candy? Girl, you've been stealing stuff from Woolworths, slipping money out of my purse. Did you say something wrong to God? You call God out his name. You've been cursing. I was 8. Nothing purple could find thread in me. All I knew was that the week before, my mother had stated, casually, while she chopped onions or tuned into Petticoat Junction or shaved a corn on her toe with a razor, your daddy ain't gonna be living here no more. In my halo shredded and my whole slice of sky started to hurt.
Patricia Smith is the author of 5 volumes of poetry, including Blood Dazzler, a finalist for the National Book Award, and Tea House of the Almighty, a National Poetry Series selection. She's a professor for the City University of New York and a Cave Canem faculty member. She lives in New Jersey with her husband and her granddaughter and some big dogs. Patricia, did you say something wrong to God? I'm not going to talk too much because they want to hear your voice, not mine.
Well, that was my mother's. My mother was staunchly religious, so much so that I think by the time she was 30 years old, she had stopped wearing pants. I don't know what God says about wearing pants, but my mother decided not to. And everything that went on in our household was centered around that. So when my father... When my father died, my mother and I looked at each other like, and you would be who? Because everything was tunneled through God's eye. God says to do this and do that and do that. And of course, you know, there are people who follow that, but it just wasn't the way I had conversations in the world.
And the way you loved your father. And when he had to spank you and you had to pretend to be hurt and he cried, this book, I could not stop reading this book.
Well, thank you so much. There's some. I'm very close to finishing my next book, and I thought it was going to be something entirely different. But I think my father is at the center of my life right now, and so the major poem in the next book is a long elegy for him.
What is the title of the next book?
I don't know. I have everything but a title.
Well, we've got the prizes lined up already. I'm shining up all the trophies for this next book because there's nowhere else to go but up from this, Patricia.
Thank you.
Let's hear more. First of all, just in one sentence, how did you keep the passion, the involvement, day after day? How did you enter this story at such a high watermark?
I think that, my mom was ashamed of being from the South. So she felt that her life started when she got to Chicago. So now I'm finding it hard to really see my own history. So there was a little bit of urgency and desperation in this, that if I didn't learn how to tell my own story, I give permission to someone else to tell it. And I don't want to do that. So it's me trying to find all the tendrils of my story and pull them together. So there was discovery as I was writing. It's like, oh, I remember that happening. Let's see how far back I can see to see what's behind it. and what role my family played in that. So it was me pushing and pushing to say, when I'm done with this book, I should know more about myself.
Well, I don't know where you got all the words, but you didn't leave any for any of us.
The same words you used.
You used every word in the world.
Same
and
words
you put
you
them
used.
Together like love. Let's hear another poem. Patricia Smith, the
sure.
Bobbitt Award winner.
Thanks. There is a long poem in here that's a conversation between my mother and father when they first met before they came to Chicago. So I'm going to read a segment that's in my mother's voice. Is there a life outside of Jesus? Then that's what I want, at least for a few days, nights. I want to put my hair up, pour myself into something shiny, open my mouth and say what I feel like saying for a change. Gonna buy me a gold dress with pearl buttons and a split up both sides. 'Cause I ain't a child no more, hanging on to Mama Ethel's hand. Next time you see me, you won't know what you're staring at. No way you look right past me. I am an up north woman now. It's about time Annie Pearl growed up, found work that ain't in dirt, learned some city words. Don't want nobody calling me country, folks thinking Alabama can't be shook off and thrown out. So I pray to God every night for that dress money, and maybe that man he named Otis.
Dress money, dress money. Is your mother alive?
My mother is alive, yes. My mother lives in a suburb of Chicago, in Oak Park.
And did she read this book?
That's a complicated question, Grace.
Well,
my mother, no. It has something to do with just kind of a secretive nature of some cultures that my mother has never really gotten used to the idea that I read my life out loud.
But does she realize that you were a national figure?
No, because you have to understand that my mother's idea of work, of a life's work, was somewhere where you went and you punched a clock and you worked for a certain number of years and they gave you a watch or a pin or something and then you had a nice retirement. The idea of that fragmented creative life where sometimes you get paid, sometimes you don't, then a book comes out, then maybe 6 years pass, another book comes out.
But you're a professor. A professor.
I know this.
That means
but
something.
She doesn't really trust in sort of the direction
my life
is taking.
But if you had gone on the conveyor belt like she did,
Like she did, because she worked in a candy factory. She didn't want that. But she would say, you can be a teacher or nurse, not a professor or doctor, a teacher or nurse. So there was still that glass ceiling.
Same thing my father said to me. Patricia Smith, talk to us some more.
Sure. I am about to read, this is one that touches on Motown. A colored girl will slice you if you talk wrong about Motown. The men and women who coupled, causing us, first arrived confounded. Surrounded by teetering towers of no, not now, and you should have known better, they cowered and built little boxes of northern home, crammed themselves inside, feasted on the familiar of fat skin and the unskimmed, made gods of doors. When we came, the same insistent bloody and question we would have been down south, they clutched us, plumped us on government cereal drenched in carnation, slathered our hair, faces, our fat wiggling arms and legs with Vaseline. We shined like the new things we were. The city squared its teeth, smiled oil, smelled the sour each hour left at the corner of our mouths. Our parents threw darts at the day. They romanced shut factories, waged hot battle with skittering roaches and vermin, lumbered after hunches. Their newborn children grew like streetlights. We grew like insurance payments. We grew like resentment. And since no tall sweet gum thrived to offer its shouldered shade, no front porch lesson spun wide to craft our wrong or righteous, our parents loosed us into the crumble, into the glass, into the hips of a new city. They trusted exploded summer hydrants, scarlet licorice whips, and crumbling rocks of government cheese to conjure a sort of joy, trusted joy to school us in the woeful limits of jukeboxes and moonwash. Freshly dunked in church water, slapped away from double negatives and country ways, we were orphans of the North Star, dutifully sacrificed, our young bodies arranged on sharp slabs of boulevard. We learned what we needed, not from our parents and their rumored South, but from the gospel seeping through the sad gap in Mary Wells' grin. Smokey slow sketched pictures of our husbands, their future skins flooded with white light, their voices all remorse and atmospheric coo. Little Stevie squeezed his eyes shut on the soul notes, replacing his dark with ours. Diana was the bone our mamas coveted, the flow of slip silver they knew was buried deep beneath their rollicking heft. Every lyric, growled or sweet from perfect brown throats, was instruction. Sit pert, pout, and seamed silk, then watch him beg. Every spun line was consolation. You're such a good girl. If he has not arrived, he will. Every wall of horn, every slick choreographed swivel threaded us with the rhythm of the mildly wild. We slept with transistor radios, worked the two silver knobs, one tiny earbud blocking out the roar of our parents' tardy attempts to retrieve us. Instead, we snuggled with the temps, lined up five pretty men across, and damned if they didn't begin every one of their songs with the same word. Girl.
Knock me out. Knock me out. We grew like sweet gum. You know what really you're doing is changing cultural attitudes, because there's so much you don't realize. How specific you are is very universal. Mm-hmm. I had fire hydrants open up in the summer. You know what I mean?
Right.
We had big speakers in the YMCA dancing. We had the penny store. And when you say that, you say, this was inimitable, but then everyone says, hey, I was a little bit of that. I was
right.
A little bit of that. And that crossing cultures is so very important. As distinctive as this culture was that you're writing about, it still reaches out. Now, I have an interesting question to ask you. Mm-hmm. You know how I teach my students that everything is fiction but the feelings.
Okay.
I have to feel that or else they won't go into autobiography. Okay, so this is autobiographical, as you say, but when you put it on the page, doesn't that magically change it? There's a sheen to it that becomes fictive just by putting it on the page? The mm-hmm. act of putting it on the page, does it become partly fiction? How much is the imagination changing reality?
Partly fiction. Well, I mean, you know, part of it is, too, that you're trying to resurrect moments, and some of it is I'm trying to resurrect moments that I've worked really hard not to remember. So I can't guarantee that everything's going to be exactly the way that it was. But I'll put it, from what I know of my mother, my father, and myself, I trust in the story that's there, and I understand that part of it is story and part of it is music. Which it has to be, because it's in the end, it's poetry. So when you try to figure out how to weave that lyricism in with what you've discovered to be factual, there's a real strong storytelling aspect to it. And it's like, you know, sitting down and saying, hey, Grace, I got this story to tell you, you know, and trying to, instead of making you a witness to the story, trying to pick you up and plop you down inside the story. And I think that's, it has to read somewhat like fiction. And what you said before about the remembered moments that wind up being the same as my remembered moments, I need for those to be clear so that you can step inside and start to live your own story.
Excellent answer. Excellent answer. And it's a complex answer, too.
Oh, thanks.
Because it's so mysterious. The process is so hard to pin down.
Sure.
But we're going to pin you down until we can't stand it anymore. So Patricia Smith is here. I'm high as a kite on the 4th of July. Read us another one.
I will. There is a long poem at the end of this book, and it's all about Motown. And it's not, I thought it was going to be celebratory, but it's a little bit about looking at Motown from the age that I am now and realizing that a lot of it was smoke and mirrors and romance, and it wasn't what life was really like. So you grow up waiting for somebody to ride up on a white horse and take you away, and that's not quite what it is. But I'm going to read two segments from that.
And do explain the form.
Yes. This is a poem. It consists of 15 sonnets. It's called A Crown of Sonnets. So the last line of the first sonnet becomes the first line of the next sonnet all the way through, okay, so until you get to the last one, which is comprised of the first lines of all the sonnets.
Was it hard?
Actually, no. There's a woman named Marilyn Nelson who's amazing with the form, and I was teaching someone with her. I was following her around. Marilyn, I want to write a crown. And she finally turned around and said, just go write one. So what you do is you write the last sonnet first, and then it's just a matter of moving the lines up. And, oh, yeah, that's the secret.
Is she still poet laureate of Connecticut?
No, I think she's retired from that, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, now you tell us the secret. But we have actually enough time for more poetry, so we're going to hear these, and then mm-hmm. we're going to go back into the book. These end the book, interestingly enough.
They do. Being young and the hearing wish. Those stories on the radio.
The dream.
Really went really far with me.
They still are. So we'll hear two of these sonnets.
Sure. Remembering how love had lied so loud, we tangled in the rhythms that we chose. Seduced by thump and sequins, heaven knows we tried to live our hopeful lives unbowed, but bending led to break. We were so proud to mirror every lyric. Radios spit beg and mend, and sturdy stereos told us what we were and weren't allowed. Our daddies sweat in factories while we found other daddies under limelight's glow. Desperate, we beg them to illuminate the glitter lives they said they'd guarantee would save us. But instead, the crippling blow. Mm. We whimpered while the downbeat dangled bait. We whimpered while the downbeat dangled bait. We leapt and swallowed all the music said while Smokey laughed and Marvin fell and bled. Their sitting slapped us hard and slapped us straight, and even then we listened for the great announcement of the drum, for tune to spread, a marvelette to pick up on the thread. But as we know by now, it's much too late to reconsider love or claw our way through all the glow they tossed to slow our roll. What we know now, we should have always known. When Smokey winked at us and whispered, "They don't love you like I do," he snagged our soul. We wound up doing the slow drag. All alone.
This group was called 13 Ways of Looking at 13, mm-hmm. page 72. So I am going to ask you to read number 3 sonnet mm-hmm. and then a couple more, even though we did hear the end. So
sure.
Let's go to number 3, which I really love.
Okay.
Page 73.
All right.
Oh, bless Miss Stein, huh?
All right. Miss Stein scribbled a word on the blackboard, said, "Who can pronounce this?" And the word was anemone. And from that moment you first felt the clutter of possible in your mouth, from the time you stumbled through the rhythm and she slow smiled, you suddenly knew you had the right to be explosive, to sling syllables through back doors, to make up your own damned words just when you needed them. All that day, sweet anemone tangled in your teeth, spurted sugar tongue, led you to the dictionary where you were assured that it existed, to the cave of the bathroom where you warbled it in bounce echo, and finally, convinced you owned that teeny gospel, you wrote it again and again and again and a...
Let's go to number 9 of these 13 ways of being
number
13.
9. Okay. With your bedroom door closed, you are skyscraper bouffant, peach foundation, eyelashes like upturned claws. You are exuding ice. You are pinched all over by earrings. You are way too much woman for this room. The audience has one chest, a single shared chance to gasp. They shudder, heave, waiting for you to open your mouth and break their hearts. Taking the stage, you become an S, pour ache into hip swings, tisk-tisk as the front row collapses. Damn, they want you. You lift the microphone. Something illegal comes out of you, a sound like titties and oil. Mama flings the door open with a church version of your name. Then you are pimpled, sexless, ashed, and double Dutch knees. You are spindles. You are singing into a hairbrush.
And let's go to the next one.
Okay.
Number 10.
This is what everyone else is doing. Skating in soul circles, skinning shins, tongue-kissing in the coat room, skimming alleys for Chicago rats, failing English, math, crushing curfew, lying about yesterday and age, slipping Woolworth's bounty into an inside pocket, sprouting breast. Here is what everyone else is doing, sampling the hotness of hooch, grinding under blue light, getting turned around in the subway, flinging all them curse words, inhaling a quick supper before supper, fried up in hot Crisco and granulated sugar, sneaking out through open windows when the night goes dark, calling mamas names under their breath, and staying up till dawn to see what hides. Here is what you are doing. Reading.
Boy, are you a professional. You just switch one of those words around so it would be okay for the Library of Congress. And then the last one,
last verse
of a 13-part long poem starts, "You're almost 14.
Mm-hmm. You are almost 14, and you think you're ready to push beyond the brutal wisdoms of the one and the three, but some nagging crave in you doesn't want to let go. You suspect that you will never be this unfinished. All Hail Mary and precipice, stuttering sachet, fuses in your swollen chest suddenly lit and spitting, and you'll need to give your hips a name for what they did while you weren't there. You'll miss the pervasive fever that signals bloom, the sore lessons of jump rope in your calves. This is the last year your father is allowed to touch you. Sighing, you push Barbie's perfect body through the thick dust of a top shelf. There, her prideful heart thunders. She has hardened you well. She has taught you everything."
Patricia Smith, I want the audience to know that this book is written with lyrical poetry, prose poetry, soliloquy, dramatic dialogue, no, dramatic monologue, also dialogue, and sonnets. Not bad for one book. Not bad. What do you teach your students?
I teach Intro to Creative Writing, which is a 4-genre, and I teach introductory and advanced poetry. I've taught women's lit, I've taught African-American literature, and I teach kind of a hybrid class that I created called, what is it called? Oh, The Evolution of Spoken Word.
Well, we would love to hear a final poem.
Sure.
And I wish it weren't the final poem, but we'll be watching you from a distance. And I'm waiting for the next book, which should come out when?
Hopefully next year.
Let's have a final poem.
Sure. The Boss of Me. In fifth grade, I was driven wild by you, my teacher, copper pixie with light shining from beneath it, eyes giggling azure through crinkled squint. I let you rub my hair. I let you probe the kinks. I clutched you, buried my nose in the sting starch of your white blouses. I asked you if you thought I was smart. Did you know how much I wanted to come home with you, to roll and cry on what had to be a bone-colored carpet? I found out where you lived. I dressed in the morning with you in mind. I spelled huge words for you. I opened the dictionary and started with A. I wanted to impress the want out of you. I didn't mind my skin because you didn't mind my skin. I opened big books and read to you and watched TV news and learned war and weather for you. I needed you in me enough to take home, enough to make me stop rocking my own bed at night, enough to ignore my daddy banging on the front door and my mama not letting him in. I prayed first to God and then to you, first to God and then to you, then to you, and next to God, then just to you. Mrs. Carol Baranowski, do you even remember the crack of surrender under your hand? Do you remember my ankle socks kissed with orange roses, socks turned perfectly down, and the click of the taps in my black shiny shoes that were always pointed toward you, always walking your way, always dancing for a word from you? I looked and looked for current, that second of flow between us, but our oceans were different. Yours was wide and blue, and mine was.
The voice of Patricia Smith, the passion and the devotion, the girl who loved books.
So good to be here. Thank you so much.
I loved it. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this possible. Funding is provided by the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry and the Reva and David Logan Foundation, with additional support by Avideh Shoshani. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 11:29 a.m. And as promised, the incomparable radio zine continues. Host Ken Jones speaking with stand-up comic Hari Kondabolu.
Regardless of who wins the next election, right? I just don't want to hear my liberal friends tell me that they're moving to Canada, right? Because I've heard this for years. If Bush wins, I'm moving to Canada. If we go to war in Iraq, I'm moving to Canada. Man, if Bush wins again, I'm moving to Canada. You're not moving to Canada. Nobody's moving to Canada. Because I don't know if you all know this, Canada does not have a special visa for American liberal cowards, right? That's not how the immigration system works. What, you think you're getting in on refugee status? That's not how the refugee system works. You have to prove that you've been persecuted and that your government wasn't there to protect you. As an American liberal coward, how are you going to prove that to a judge? Man, you know what we've been through, man. It's practically Somalia down there. I mean, Rush Limbaugh's an idiot, and they put high fructose corn syrup in everything. And my God, nobody composts. I mean, they're killing us. Slowly, but they're killing us.
Welcome to another edition of Radio Zine here on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Ken Jones, your host for today's show. In this episode, we interview Hari Kondabolu, who the New York Times calls one of the most exciting political comics in stand-up today. Currently based in Brooklyn,